This month's podcast features Dr. John Brown, Clinical Associate Professor at the UMass Lowell School of Education, and his journey within the vast world of instruction. Professor Brown has been teaching both graduate and undergraduate education courses at UMass Lowell for the past 10 years after earning his doctorate from the same institution. He is also the founder of the Teacher Leadership Network, a community of professional educators committed to opening and maintaining a dialogue about what learning can and should be in the 21st century. Founded by educators for educators, they work together to support effective and innovative teaching models, value identity and integrity, and promote equity, diversity, and a healthy work and life balance for educators at all levels. In this podcast, we'll hear how Professor Brown developed and refined his teaching skills for his vocational technical high school students.
Can I watch you guys teach? I was thinking, what can they teach me? But the students loved going to shop, and then they clearly became successful electricians and plumbers and bakers and, you know, and nurses. And I'm like, how does that happen? These students who won't even open their book for me are going to be successful nurses?
How his work as a professor at UMass Lowell led to the creation of the Teacher Leadership Network.
This organization that almost completely made up of my former students and former colleagues called Teacher Leadership Network. It's because we had this one class that was really gelled, and they, once they graduated, it was like a cohort, so to speak. They were all in the same classes together. They all became teachers in different schools. One's in Revere, one's in Lowell, one's in Lawrence.
And what teachers can do today to not only help them succeed in the classroom, but to also help their students succeed.
But when a new person enters the field, the most important thing that they need to do is connect with their students, which is what I didn't do when I started at Shawsheen. I didn't connect with my students. I didn't let them know who I was. I didn't learn who they were. I didn't care enough who they were as people.
This podcast was created by JFY Networks, a Boston-based nonprofit provider of online learning programs to schools, students, and parents. JFY's individualized self-paced curricula help raise individual and school performance measures by maintaining grade-level skills and combating learning loss. JFY provides online ELA and math curricula aligned to state and college standards from grade 5 through high school, with personal support online and via telephone from friendly learning specialists like yours truly. JFY supports all educational communities and provides free scholastic resources on our website at jfynet.org. For JFY Networks, I'm Greg Cunningham. Professor Brown is very candid about his less-than-stellar beginnings as a high school teacher. After teaching at a school for special education students, he moved to Shawsheen Valley Technical High School and was not nearly prepared for the change.
And I'll start by saying that shortly after I graduated, we graduated from Stonehill, I took a job at a school called Landmark School, which is a school for students with dyslexia. And I was there for 3 years. It's a great school. It's where I learned to teach, completely skills-based curriculum, not very content-focused. This is long before the Ed Reform Law of 93. This is back in 1990. And I was there for 3 years. And the reason I was there for 3 years was because, well, there are two reasons that I left. One is because the pay was really lousy. It was $14,250 a year. And I don't know how much I get paid now, but I know how much I got paid then, because when you get paid that little, every cent counts. And I got $14,250 my first year, second year, and third year. And then I got in, I became interested in maybe doing something else. So I went and got a master's degree in English. And then after that, I took a job at a very different school, Shawsheen Technical High School in Billerica. It's a voc technical high school. I knew nothing about voc tech schools at the time. I took the job sort of on a whim. Like I applied to it the year before they hired me. They hired somebody else, and that person didn't make it. They quit like a couple of days before the school year, the 96-97 school year started. And I come walking in there like the day before the school year, and they interviewed me and hired me the same day. And I was making like between 2 and 3 times as much as I was making at Landmark. But the awful surprise was that my class size was huge. And they had a different kind of problem attaining language arts skills. I was a language arts teacher, literacy skills, reading comprehension, vocabulary, writing, written expression. And mostly that was because they were tactile, kinesthetic students. They'd come to that school for an experiential learning, and they were getting it half of the time in their shops, whether they were culinary arts or mechanics or something like that, or computers, they were getting it there, but they weren't getting it in their academic courses. So I went from being like an okay fourth year teacher to being really bad. I was terrible. I was trying to apply what I learned at Landmark to a different population with a different model. Instead of having 7 students in a class, I had 27 students, and I had very little support. There was no MCAS at the time. So at the time, there wasn't a lot of, and I don't want to give MCAS any credit here, but it's going to sound like I am, and I sort of am, because there was no attention to improvement of student skills until 2 things happened. One was MCAS. The other one was our boss, who was smart, was doing a pre and post test. This is long before it became popular during the teacher evaluation craze, and quantitative evidence for teacher student improvement and reflecting that back to teachers. We all know that's far more complicated than the Department of Education seems to think it is. But my boss had us using a Stanford diagnostic reading test at the beginning of the year and at the end of the year, and he could, you know, chart individual students' growth, students, groups of students, and then he was quietly tracking teachers based on their students' performance, which is, like I said before, a little bit unfair. But long-term, over long periods of time, it does show something, like a good match for, you know, that teacher's decisions that they make about curriculum and instruction and what those students need. So my first year, I was not a good teacher. My students did not like being there. I had to refer them for behavior problems all the time. They weren't what we now call engaged, or what we used to call motivated. They weren't listening to me, and I was trying to force them, and that doesn't work very well, because they weren't going to school after this. They were going to go to get a job in the trade. So the only teachers they cared about were the teachers in their shops. So my bosses didn't know I was terrible, and I learned everything you need to know about teaching that year. And maybe the year after, which I was still pretty bad. Because when you're really bad at something and you have the courage to take a look at to reflect on it, you learn things about yourself, and you learn things about teaching that you wouldn't otherwise learn. And you create a list in your head of things not to do. Like, don't try to force these people to do this stuff. Or naturally, we're forcing students to do things all the time. Just use as little force as necessary. I changed my approach radically. I was going to quit at the end of the year because I was miserable. And then I decided I'm going to come back and do things very differently. And I wasn't being supervised in a microscopic way like teachers are perhaps now. So I started doing some way outside of the box things. And some of them worked and some of them didn't work. But when they worked, we could tell, because my boss was tracking things with the SDRT. So at the end of my second year, he calls me in. He's like, what are you doing in there? And I'm like, I don't know. I was not a good engineer, because an engineer will try something. And then they won't introduce something new until they're done introducing the first thing, because they want to be able to attribute the outcome to what you tried, right? So I'm not a scientist. I'm more of an artist. So he's like, what are you doing in there? And I had tried so many things on top of each other that I couldn't track any of them back to the outcome, which was good after that second year. After the first year, my student scores were flat. I didn't even pay any attention to that. I was not even 100% aware that they were being tested and then retested and that he was analyzing it. He was just starting the program at the time and he didn't want to make any decisions based on it because he was just starting it. I was new, so he wasn't going to make, he was a decent boss, so he wasn't going to, you know, fire me based on 1 year's performance with an instrument that he hadn't been using very long that I didn't even know he was using really. And I was just getting my feet wet with a new population. So after the second year, he pays attention. He goes, wow, this guy's scores, which were completely flat, his student scores are higher now. So he asked me what's going on. And I don't know. And they were significantly higher. So, and I didn't, the second year, I didn't care about the test either. I knew that it existed. I didn't care about it. The students, there was nothing hanging over their head like MCAS. Eventually, it became a graduation requirement. This wasn't a graduation requirement. They didn't get a grade for it or anything. So I'm like, I don't know, boss. And looking back on it, I think he thought I might have been cheating. But he quickly realized I wasn't, because that I wasn't really 100% even aware of the test. That how can this guy be cheating if he doesn't even care about it and doesn't know about it? And looking back, I still don't know what attributed to my success that year. But the next years, I started to think about it. And it was basically real data-driven decision-making because I knew these people, meaning the students that were taking the test. I knew these people that I was seeing every day. So I started to do some data-driven decision-making and I became more and more successful without thinking about the test or teaching to the test, which is not a test you can teach to very easily.
Professor Brown knew he wanted to improve as a teacher, and after some reflection and keen observations about his students, he sought help from his colleagues who at first were skeptical of his motives.
But some of the things that I was, one of the main things I was doing that I didn't realize at first was I was forcing students less. I was being less forceful as I continued to teach at that school. And I learned that because I was so bad the first year that when I decided I would come back, I needed to know what these students were like. So I started asking their shop teachers, can I watch you guys, you know, work? And these guys didn't have college degrees. I'm still friends with some of them. They had dirt under their fingernails. They're great teachers, but I was a snob about it because I didn't know. And I was, can I watch you guys teach? I was thinking, what can they teach me? But the students loved going to shop. And then they clearly became successful electricians and plumbers and bakers and, you know, and nurses. And I'm like, how does that happen? These students who won't even open their book for me are going to be successful nurses? Like, how is that? So I start, the teachers, the voc ed teachers were like, all right, they were suspicious of me. They were like, all right, we'll let you sit in the corner over there. Just don't make any noise. And I think they thought that I was maybe a spy or something. And they quickly realized I wasn't, that I was just an idiot. And I was just fumbling along. And I'd ask them questions later. And that's what really gave me away as being a fool. Like, how do you get the students to, you know, to try at this skill, whatever it was, like they were building a house 1 year for Habitat for Humanity. And how do you get them to try, you know, using a nail gun? There was a student who was like a sophomore, and she was a girl, and she's unstable with the nail gun. She's like, are you sure I can do it? Yeah. And she fires the thing off and it goes wrong. it doesn't hit it right. It splits the stud and the teacher says, well, what you guys do in academia is you give them an F when that happens. But we say, do it over. And I said, I don't get it. And he's like, yeah, I can see that. But what you don't get is that failure is part of our curriculum here. So if somebody brings their car into the auto shop and which ended up happening to me later on. And they need to replace your starter, and the kid accidentally puts a hole in your radiator. We don't yell at them for that, because we want to reward or affirm, or we want them. We don't want them to be to not try. We want them to take risks. And I knew this from my world as an academic risk, taking an academic risk. And he was right. We had been punishing students. I had been doing it too, part of a big club of people who would punish students for not being compliant, you know, not sitting down and paying attention and asking too many questions. And so I started doing that. I started saying, so what do you guys have any questions? And they would ask a million questions. And I would say, okay, that's enough. And I went back to the shop teachers, like, they have to ask all their questions. That is an important part of their learning, is asking all those questions. I'm like, why? Because they need to know that stuff, the teachers would say, and they need to feel heard. I'm like, yeah, but I'm not going to get all the curriculum in. If I let them ask all that questions, we'll get nothing else done. He goes, it doesn't matter. You know, the teachers would say, the tech teachers would say, it doesn't matter whether you get that stuff done or not. Because if you get it done, it doesn't mean they learned it. It just means that you were talking. And I'm like, and they're the voc tech teachers, these vocational technical teachers were so plain spoken and so direct with me that I couldn't not see it. And then I'd go and I'd do it, like I'd skip my lunch and watch like the masonry teacher teach students how to build a wall. And then I'd quickly run back to, because I didn't have a lot of time, run back to teach my next class. And the things that the masonry teacher was saying were evident right in front of me at that point. And I'm like, oh, wow. So I started paying attention more to my students, just paying attention to them more. And just by paying attention to them more, they would pay attention to me more. And I was like, wow, I'm not entitled to these people's attention. I have to earn this. And they don't care that what I have to say automatically, but they could care what I have to say if I give them a reason to.
Building credibility for his students turned out to be essential in order to help build their trust. Professor Brown's writings as a professional magazine writer helped his students see him not just a teacher of writing, but as a professional writer.
At the time, I was writing for a fishing magazine just for fun, and I was getting paid for it. And the student said, yeah, you're nothing one day. You're nothing like our shop teachers because, and I'm like, well, how would I be? How could that be? You know, I teach reading, writing, you know, how could that be? And they're like, well, if you were an actual writer, and I said, well, I sort of am. I write for this fishing magazine. They're like, oh, really? Can we see those? And I'm like, all right. So I bring in the fishing magazine and they're reading it. And they're like, oh, wow, you wrote this. You're the guy. And it had my picture on it too, like a little columnist. It's a fishing magazine called On the Water, which is actually a fairly big magazine now. Back then, it was not as big a deal. And so I was writing. I had a column in it, and I wrote articles for it. Like, oh, dude, you are. So you actually, that was credibility for them. Like my teachers now, who are learning to be teachers, I have credibility with them because I was a teacher. I had a credibility with my students at that point because I had actually published something. Like their shop teachers had actually baked a loaf of bread and sold it and somebody ate it. Or they had drawn blueprints for the house they were going to build on a CAD program, a CAD program, and printed it out. And they used it to build a house. And you could say, there's the house. And some person bought the house. You know, they didn't buy it, but they built this Habitat for Humanity. Somebody's living in it. And they're like, that's real. And you wrote an article. That's real. And I was like, okay. So I started talking to them, paying attention to my students, talking to my students. And I started thinking about what I was doing that wasn't working. And then I took it to a whole new level. I started asking them what wasn't working. So I learned this trick that it was in a course I took called the Teaching of Writing. It was called A Status of the Class. And it's for the writer's workshop model, which is like Nancy Atwell, Lucy Calkins, that kind of thing. And one of the things that Nancy Atwell used to do it up in Maine, where she'd have a status of the class meeting where she'd say, how are things going, you know, with the way we're running class. So I would have it much more globally. I would wasn't just about writing, but I would say, how are things going every week? I would at the end of the class on a Friday, and we had to meet twice a day, my classes, because they had shop 1 week and academics the next. So they would cram two English into one day during the academic week. So on a Friday afternoon, when students generally didn't want to listen to me anyway, I'd ask them, and they would listen then because they would talk. I'd say, what am I doing wrong? What could I do better? And they loved criticizing. It was like retribution for them. And they're like, oh, you can do this and you can do that. It was the most valuable stuff because the information I got that was just them being nasty or it was not logical, I could tell that it wasn't going to be helpful. But almost every one of those conversations had legitimate feedback in there. It was, and I wasn't getting enough feedback from my bosses about my teaching because they weren't observing me often enough. And then later on, when observation became a huge part of teacher evaluation, still, I wasn't getting enough of that because it became a numbers game at that point. And teachers were trying to insulate themselves from getting fired. And sometimes their bosses were too. They were complicit in it. And it was more about teach point and checking boxes than it was about giving actual feedback. So my students became my bosses. They became my evaluators in a way.
Obtaining another academic degree was not on Professor Brown's radar, but the principal for whom he worked saw something in him and pushed the unwilling English teacher toward a doctorate degree.
Eventually, my boss says to me, wow, you're doing a good job here and you don't know why, huh? And I'm like, no, I have no idea. He's like, well, you ought to, he had just graduated from the University of Massachusetts in Lowell, doctoral program. He goes, you ought to figure it out. I'm like, well, how would I do that? He goes, go into the doc program and study yourself. I'm like, that's what people do. He goes, I don't know, but you'll learn something there that you maybe figure out what you're doing while you're there. And I'm like, I'm not going to get another degree. I can barely tread water here. And he's like, oh, okay, well, don't do it then. So later on, he bugged me about it. And I said, I'm going to apply just to show you I'm not going to get in. And I applied to that one program, no other ones. It wasn't an idea. It wasn't my idea. And I got in. I had written about how I was a terrible teacher and that I just figured I didn't know what to write in my essay. So I just wrote the thing I just told you. Like I was a terrible teacher. And then I figured out how to be better by listening to my students and paying attention to them and watching their teachers, the teachers that were successful, watching other teachers, the vocational teachers especially. And I had also developed a situation where, and I stole this from the vocational teachers, they used to give their students jobs. So they would run their shop, which was a giant classroom that lasted all day long, like it was a business. And they would put this kid in charge of this and that kid in charge of that. And I loved that. I'm like, oh, I'm going to do that. They're going to feel like a sense of ownership and I'm going to have less to do. And I was like drowning in paperwork and things like that. And that was even before DESE went crazy with, you know, forcing schools to do paperwork and schools started overreacting and doing more and more paperwork. So I was running my classroom like a shop/business. It was nothing like an English class. It had couches in it. It looked like a Starbucks. It had, in fact, this bookcase that's behind me here, I found on the street and I put it in my classroom because we were doing the Nancy Atwell kind of thing and they could choose their book out of it. But we actually had a classroom librarian, as an example. And the librarian worked for, not me, but somebody I put in charge of running the class. So I delegated everything. And people couldn't even, students weren't even allowed to talk to me unless they talked to that person first. So I get into UMass Lowell, and my wife says, what are you going to do? I'm like, I'm going to take a course. I'm going to take the first course. I'm not going to get a doctorate. I'll never finish. It'll take forever. It'll take 10 years for me to finish it, like one class at a time. And I'm not going to leave my job. By then, she was pregnant. And I was like, okay, well, I can't afford to leave my job. So I'll just take one class at a time. And it'll help me stay certified because teacher recertification had come along at that point, and it'll help me climb up the pay scale. I'll just take one class at a time until it gets really hard, and then I'll drop out. And people would say, hey, you're working on your doctorate. I'm like, no, I'm not. I'm just taking classes. So eventually, I got to stats, and I'm like, okay, this is where I drop out. I planned on it because I was doing really terrible in stats. I hadn't taken math since high school. So the principal of the school, who I'm friendly with now, and absolutely lives down the street from me, he's retired. He was in the doctoral program at BC, and he said, oh, how's it going over there at UMass Lowell? I said, all right, it's good, but I'm going to drop out because I'm not going to make it through stats. And he says, oh, why? And he asks me, and the professor that I had at UMass Lowell was not very customer service friendly. If I wasn't going to make it, he didn't care. I just didn't have the math skills. I needed some basic math skills to be able to do this work. And he says, well, stats is fairly easy. I said, it doesn't feel easy. He goes, well, you're just missing some foundational stuff. Do you have a tutor? I said, yeah, he assigned me a tutor and the person's no good. The person doesn't help me. And he goes, well, I'll tutor you. And I'm like, you're going to tutor me in math so I can pass stats. I go, it's the first of two stats courses. And he goes, well, if it becomes too much, we can stop and then you can drop out. But let's just give it a shot. So he and I ended up developing a relationship. He tutored me. I passed with a B. And I took the second course. I passed that with a B. And then he's like, well, now you're on your way. And there were many more challenges in the process. But now he was kind of invested with me. Like, he was in his doctoral program. I was in my doctoral program. He started talking to me about what he was doing in his program. We would meet every week, like when we would meet regularly for him to tutor me. We just kept meeting. Then I did an apprenticeship with him, like to become a principal, because I was doing the hours anyway. But eventually, when I graduated from UMass with a doctorate, they hired me as an adjunct, and they kept me on for a few years before they recruited me to teach there full time. So now what I do is I teach in the graduate school. And I teach people who want to become teachers. They already have their bachelor's degrees and they're going for their initial certification, their DESE initial certification. And most of them want to become ELA teachers, grades 5 or 6 through 12. But then I teach some other classes in the online program that are more general, that are curriculum classes or classes that are focused on pedagogy. I teach a technology class. And I've been there it'll be 10 years next year. And it's flown by.
It was from the classes he taught that the Teacher Leadership Network was born. A vast community of over 200 educators today, the group had a rather small and humble beginning.
And it's given me some time to do some other things. One of those other things is this organization that almost completely made up of my former students and former colleagues called Teacher Leadership Network. It's because we had this one class that was really gelled. And they, once they graduated, it was like a cohort, so to speak. They were all in the same classes together. And they all became teachers in different schools. One's in Revere, one's in Lowell, one's in Lawrence. And the next year, I ran a teacher panel and I invited them to come back and be in the teacher panel. So my current students could ask my former students, what's it like to be a teacher and what kind of problems do you have? And tell us what it's like. After that event, they were talking to each other and they said, hey, we should get together once in a while and compare notes, what our schools are like, and maybe help each other out a little bit. And they said, Brown, would you organize that? I'm like, no, I'm not organizing that. It sounds like work. And then I organized it and we called it Salon initially, which was silly. And it was in my house. So it was just that class. It was like 6 people that would get together once a year and talk about teaching and say, and then eventually they came up with this problem solving protocol. You'd call it they would call it a protocol now, but it was just a process. Like, I have a problem. And then everybody would listen to their problem. And if you've ever heard of critical friends, like groups, which is like from the Quakers, I guess, somebody describes their problem and people ask questions about it without giving them advice, they can get a new perspective on the problem. So I was familiar with that from reading the book, The Courage to Teach by Parker Palmer. He talks about it in there, like clearness committees or something. And so I said, well, let's adapt that like for this. And then more teachers jumped in, and then other teachers heard about it. And then each one of these teachers in this group wanted to bring a friend. So we couldn't have it in my house anymore. So we started having it at other venues. We had it anywhere we could, anywhere we could find enough space. One time we had it at a marina where I kept my boat because they had a big like function room that they loaned me for free. Just a bunch of teachers talking. Okay, we're not having a wedding or anything. I'm no. Okay, we don't have to clean up. No. And then once we had it at the iHub, which is like a business incubator in Lowell that's run by the university. And I know the guy who directs it, and he had a big room. And I'm like, can I borrow this room? And it became like a networking group, sort of. But it also was PD-ish, because even though it wasn't a classic, you're going to take a class in universal design. It wasn't like that where it had a theme, like people would show up with their problems. And other people would show up and say, well, I want to listen to your problems because they might be the same problems I have. And one time somebody shows up and says, I remember her name was Helen. She says, I just got, and by then we were doing it four times a year. She goes, I just got let go. My school let me go. And so everybody kind of comforted her, and it was like a support group sort of. And then somebody says, oh, I know my school might be looking for somebody. They might have you have a job coming up. And she ended up working at that school. So she got a job from it. So that became a thing. Like, oh, we can, you know, work-life balance. That's an important part of this. And support group. Like, I have a problem with the intersection of my personal life and my professional life. Or I get a problem with my boss. Or people didn't know. They're new teachers, and they don't know anything about unions. And they don't know, you know, oh, I work at a charter school, and we have these issues. And so we started having workshops, we guest speakers and panel discussions, and it still wasn't and still isn't very formal. Students, former students, current members, there are 250 members now, started asking, can we get PDPs for this stuff? I said no and no and no, and then finally applied to become a PDP provider with DESC, and they rejected my application because of some technicality. And I said, no, again, but I'm probably going to do it, fill it out again. So it became something that people were like, this is a good PD because it's self-differentiating. It's not like the people running it have to say, what do we need? It just automatically becomes what we need and morphs into it. It's for me, it's a good place to be in touch with my former students and get the kind of feedback I was talking about before, where I need to know just for my job, like, was I doing the right thing when I was teaching you stuff? Did I give you anything useful, or what was the waste of time? Which books, looking back, like now that you're a teacher, which books were useless? And they would sometimes disagree, but whenever they agreed, I would be like, oh, maybe I should not use that book. You know, or you don't even need a book, Brown. You can just give us all those materials you have, that Google Drive you have. You can just show us how to navigate through that, and that would be all you need to do. And then the student people would be like, no. And those conversations started happening in what became TLN, or Teacher Leadership Network. And we're not a nonprofit technically, but that's something that we're thinking about doing, because if we were, we could probably get a grant or something. And then maybe if we had a workshop and we hired somebody to teach the workshop, we could maybe, it could be free to members. I don't know. We don't even know what we're going to do, like whether we're going to have a membership fee or whatever, but it's just, and there's a Facebook group. So one of the members said, oh, let's make a Facebook group page. And so the Facebook group has, you know, it has 250 members, and they ask each other questions like, oh, if you're doing a unit on To Kill a Mockingbird, which would you do first, this or that? And a lot of them are English teachers because they're my former students, but some of them aren't. Some of them are students from other places in the country because I teach online for the university in the reading and language program or in the curriculum instruction program, which are not just high school, but they're K through 12. And so people ask each other questions, and other people say, oh, you might look at this, you might look at that. And so they use that all the time, and I peek at it once in a while, but I don't even participate in it. They help each other out, and they're still getting each other's job. They put, I just lost my job. does somebody have any idea where I can apply and have, oh yeah, my school, and then a bunch of people perk up, and that's just Facebook. There's actually a Twitter and a LinkedIn and an Instagram too, but those things aren't, they're not as useful as the Facebook part, because that's much more interactive. People are, and the moderator, I'm technically one of the administrator of the Facebook thing, but there's actually a moderator who's a member of the group who moderates the thing and makes sure that things get taken down and put up and kind of it gets curated that way. So, and we've come up with a way to let people in the group. So you have to be invited by a member of the group. So that's kind of sorts like loose governance. We don't have a board or anything, but when somebody comes up with an idea, I just shoot it out to the group. And if I don't get an answer, I call up the core members, the people who do most of the volunteering. And I say, should we do this? Like, there's a teacher in New Hampshire right now who wants to start a writing teachers group. So it's almost like a TLN just for writing teachers. And she wants to run it. And I said, well, you know, I don't want to do that. She goes, well, I'll run it. It'll be like a thread running through TLN. So I said, yeah, that sounds like a great idea. Let me bounce it off these five people. And they're like, yeah, why wouldn't you do that? I'm like, all right, let's do that. So that's something that we're going to do probably this coming year. They'll probably end up being a technology group. I used to teach two technology classes. Now I just teach one, but all my former students there are like, why don't we have a technology group? And that way you can, and there are a lot of these groups already out there. There are tons of them, but these people all know each other because they've talked to each other on Zoom. They've talked to each other in person for years. We had a beach day one time. We had a TLN beach day where they said, well, what's the topic of the beach day? I'm like, the beach. Like, there's no topic. It's just so you guys can hang out at the beach. So we all went to the beach one day and got pizzas, and not all. There weren't 250 people there. There were like probably a dozen at the most, but they brought their kids. So then it was, you know, a dozen plus kids, dogs and stuff. And we'll probably have another, we had an event where somebody in the group got their doctorate and somebody else in the group had been hired. And so we had a celebration. So look, this is a good excuse to like get together and eat something. So if you don't have that aspect of it, then it becomes no different than like taking a lousy course or taking a PD, and even though it's free, but they're not getting any credits for it. So after a while, that, you know, the pizza goes a long way because people can just chat rather than have this super structured thing like a class. So TLN is also, it's got a podcast called Teacher Talk. It's got a newsletter, and I host the podcast, but usually the podcast is open to anybody, and it's like a talk show. So it's like this, but it's live. So, and it's not heavily edited because I don't want to edit it, because that's a lot of work.
The number of teachers leaving the profession for other jobs has been on the rise in recent years. Professor Brown is committed to his undergraduate and graduate students to help them find success in the classroom and thus remain dedicated to the profession as long as possible.
But when a new person enters the field, the most important thing that they need to do is connect with their students, which is what I didn't do when I started at Shawsheen. I didn't connect with my students. I didn't let them know who I was. I didn't learn who they were. I didn't care enough who they were as people. If you don't do that, then whatever comes out of you next, whether it's assignments or talk or it's whatever you ask students to do, it's all about compliance. And that's superficially effective for well-behaved, middle-class, college prep kids, but only superficially. They're only learning it to get a grade. They're not learning it to learn it. They're learning it to comply. They're not learning it for their own edification. Compliance is really about force. So the teacher is complying to the boss, and the boss is complying to DESE. It's a chain of compliance. Students are forced to comply automatically just by being forced to go to school, because in, you know, the age of dropping. The dropout age is 16, I guess. So it's illegal to drop out before that. And parents can be held accountable if kids drop out before that. But of course, students who don't drop out still can drop out. And that's by attending school, but not really paying attention or just doing the minimum to get by. And then there's a level of social promotion everywhere. Like, I have a student who's got a 60, but they really have a 58, but it's not going to do much good to keep them back. And the truth is, you know, the data shows it's not going to do that much good to keep them back by the time they're in high school, which is when I had them. So having students attend class is super important, but having students like care about the class, pay attention in class, requires the teacher to care about the class, requires the teacher to care about the students and to listen to them. Teachers don't have to do what I was doing, which is like have a meeting asking students to criticize them. That's pretty radical. But just students, just teachers who pay attention to their students, just watching them, are going to be more successful. And there's a great study that came out in 2018. I forget which journal it was in, but the protocol that was tested was called positive greetings at the door. And so this is something I've been doing for years, and good teachers generally do, but it was data that kind of showed that how effective it is and explored why. So in the study, which was a experimental study, the teacher stands in the doorway when the students are coming in and leaving between classes, like middle school or high school. And the protocol is the teacher says hi to each student for the most part and uses their name and says something positive if possible and is paying attention to them, paying attention to their reaction to what they say as they come and go. They're not checking their watch or their phone. They're not talking to the other teacher that's next door. They're not preparing their lesson. They're not talking to an individual student about makeup work. They're focusing on this task of welcoming students into the class and using their names and saying, hi, Greg, how are you today? I heard that the football team won. Congratulations. I know you didn't play, but you're part of the team, or wow, I heard you caught the winning pass, or what? It could be something else. It could be, it could be the debate team. I heard the debate team, went to the championship. You didn't win, but it was close. Or Skills USA is something my students used to do when they were vocational students. It was a competition about where they compete building stuff. Like, I built a wall, or I built a staircase, or I built a chimney. I used to go and watch the masonry competition because I had a friend who was the masonry teacher. And I might say, oh, I heard that you medaled at Skills USA. Congratulations. Was it a bronze or a silver? Oh, it's a silver brown. I'd never medaled before. That's fantastic. And the data shows that teachers just doing that, which isn't just because it takes a lot of work to do that every time classes change. And then you start to see things that you don't want to see. Like, I see this person's upset, or I see this person's angry, or I see this person's, high. And then you got to follow up on some of that stuff because it's your responsibility to. And sometimes it's easier not to see that stuff, so you don't follow up on it. But if you don't follow up on that stuff, your students aren't going to learn, because if they're high, they're not going to learn. If they're angry, they're not going to learn. If they're sad or scared, they're not going to learn. So this is the SEL, they call it, social and emotional learning, but at the real deep level, at the substantive, authentic level, not like, I'm going to say some things that represent the social and emotional learning objectives that the Department of Education wants me to have, or the SEL MA network wants me to have. And I'm not saying those things that DESE embracing SEL or the SEL for Massachusetts people are wrong or bad or anything like that, but all they can do is talk about methods. They can't talk about what's actually going on. This is what's actually going on. It's listening, paying attention. And so the study showed that if the teachers who did that, and that's all they did, versus teachers who weren't paying attention to the students as they came and went, they were doing the other things that teachers sometimes do, which is checking their email, which my wife now does on her wrist. They're talking to an individual student about makeup work, or they're talking to another teacher, or they're checking their lesson plan or whatever. The data was overwhelming, showing there are fewer disturbances, and the students do better during the next class, and the students do better academically in those classes as well. It's an article I now assign to my students, but before the article existed, that was 2018, so it's a few years ago, I used to talk about that's one of the things I do. It's a very practical thing you can do. Is just pay attention to your students as they come into the class and when they leave. Sometimes a student will look upset about something. And I remember making the mistake and saying, hey, why don't you come and talk to me later? Which is actually a little bit forceful. Because if they don't come, maybe they'll think that you'll be mad that they didn't come. And so now they come because you want them to, out of compliance. So I started paying attention to the nuance there. And I see this person was clearly upset, but I wasn't going to say anything in that moment because class is starting. I can't deal with it. They don't want to deal with it at that point. And so I learned the subtlety of the vocabulary that needs to go on in developing that relationship in between all the other things I was doing as a teacher, including teaching academic information. And I'd say something like, I'll be here after school for a little while if you want to talk, which is not at all using my authority to suggest anything. It's just like, I'll be here if you want to. If you don't, that's fine too. And students don't do things the way you expect they will. They don't like, oh, that student came because I invited them. But their circumstances changed during the day and they got distracted. They either distracted themselves because they didn't want to deal with the emotions, or they just became distracted, period. So it wasn't that big a deal. And then 3 weeks later, when whatever nasty bullying or whatever it was happened again, and it brought up, it reopened that wound or whatever it was, the student comes wandering into your room on a day that you're not planning on staying after because you have to take your own kids somewhere to a baseball game or something, comes wandering in and going, hey, how you doing? And they don't tell you they need you. And you don't remember ever offering it. How you doing? And you're like, what are you doing here? You making up work here? What's going on? What do you need? Well, and then you realize, oh, this person's here for something else. And you put your stuff down and you're like, look, I can't talk to you right now. I don't want to get into this and open this up if I'm just going to walk out. And if I start talking about it now, I'm going to be thinking about where I need to be, which is with my kids. If you're serious about this, let's do this another time. These are the days I'll be after school the next couple of weeks. Come some other time. And if there's somebody in here getting makeup work and you want them to leave, just signal to me, kick that person out. I need to talk to you about. And it would sometimes be something minor, like another teacher hurt my feelings, or you hurt my feelings, or a kid hurt my feelings, or I'm afraid I'm failing something. Or it could be something major, like I have a learning disability and the other kids are making fun of me, or I got cut from the team because they caught us drinking, but I wasn't really drinking, you know? And those conversations, and I'm being just totally selfish here, totally Machiavellian. And I care about my students. So those conversations helped them. But all I did was listen. And what it got me was not credibility. It got me relationship with that student. That student was less apt to misbehave in class. That student was more asked to ask questions when they didn't understand something. And if a student doesn't understand something and they don't ask the question, they're going to fall behind. So those, and they establish a level of trust where they can take a risk now. They can ask for academic help now because they asked for help with this other thing, this personal problem, you know? So I learned by screwing up, but I also learn by listening to students. So the new teacher has to develop that relationship. That's one way of doing it, the whole positive greetings at the door way of doing it. But there are other ways to develop relationships with students that make it possible to have like somewhat orderly classes where you get things somewhat done and there isn't a lot of disruption, without the need for behaviorist classical conditioning where you punish and reward and there's like a series of reinforcements, because those experiments that were done by Watson and Skinner and then were picked up by people like Thorndike, who was a curriculum guy, but was totally into behaviorism and conditioning to try to get people to change their behavior, because changing behavior is like teaching, right? But those experiments, those psychologists who weren't teachers were doing, were mostly on animals. and they worked Pavlov, right? Pavlov's dog. They worked well on animals, but they don't work as well on adolescents. They probably would work well on little kids or maybe even adults, but adolescents are volatile. So you punish them, and the reaction to the punishment could be so negative, and the resentment could be so negative that it doesn't even matter what you're punishing them for. What you were trying to accomplish is lost in the resentment of the punishment or the reward. You're rewarding them, so you're bribing them to keep doing it. Well, then they're not doing it for they're not doing it for themselves. They're doing it for you. So it's not sustainable. Once you stop giving them the prize or the bribe, whatever it is, even if it's just a nice thing to say, even if it's just positive reinforcement, which is completely overrated. Once you stop doing that, they'll stop performing.
Professor Brown works with his graduate students to help them understand students must be motivated not by grades or test scores, but by a genuine investment into their own education. Demanding compliance from students or teachers or schools is not the answer.
My students, when they were at the Voc Tech school, were doing it because they wanted a life that was like their teacher's life. So my teacher's a diesel mechanic and I want to be a diesel mechanic. So not I want to get a job doing diesel mechanics. I want to be a diesel mechanic. It was like identity. So it was far more complicated than anything that like the teacher evaluation system in Massachusetts could bring out of a system in systems thinking, or the MCAS and Ed Reform Law of 1993 with MTEL and MCAS and shutting schools down and giving them different labels like level one school, level two school, level three school, level five school. That's it. Receivership. That's all force. So, and what it leads to is more force. So if you go into schools, and I see schools all the time because I supervise student teachers in lots of different kinds of schools. I've been in Lawrence. I've been in Lowell. I've been in Westford, I've been in Masconomet High School. And those are like high-end, like socioeconomically rich towns. But right on the other side of 495 from Andover, for example, or North Andover or North Reading is Lawrence. And the deeper the hole performance-wise, as far as how they're rated, these schools are rated, the more compliance agencies like the state of Massachusetts want over the school. And the more compliance those administrators want over their teachers, and the more compliance those teachers want over their students. And that's not what they need. They don't need more compliance. They need more patience. They need more care. So what new teachers get lost in is ideas about curriculum, like what am I going to teach and how am I going to deliver the instruction, which are very important, but they're not relevant unless you've made the connection with the students. And that connection's not, it takes a little bit of courage to make because you have to be yourself. I was talking to somebody the other day about teaching literature and teaching poetry in particular. And a lot of English teachers that I knew were afraid of teaching poetry because they were afraid they might not know what the poem means, even though they might claim to be pluralists and not dualists in their thinking about. Or they might claim to be reader response theorists as opposed to new critical theorists. Like there isn't a right answer, but then they're afraid to teach a poem that they don't know the answer to. It takes a certain amount of courage to start with, okay, I got a poem for you guys today, and I'm not sure what it means, but this is what I think. And you're modeling what you want them to do. You want them to say, yeah, I'm not sure what it means, but this is what I think. As opposed to, this is the right interpretation, that's the wrong interpretation, which would make grading easier. But grading's not all that valuable. So new teachers need to be able to talk to other new teachers and just other teachers so they can learn that it's not a clean, that success in teaching isn't clean. It's not orderly. And the other one is that they need to connect with their students as early as possible.
Teachers will face new and unique challenges this fall as they return to the classroom after online and hybrid teaching platforms interrupted not just student education, but also the relationship students have with their teachers and their schools. The community members of the Teacher Leadership Network recognize this problem and will work together to help create solutions.
So TLN's doing a workshop in like a couple of weeks for members Like, we're going back into the classroom, year three, technically, of the pandemic. What are we concerned about? We'll be talking about that. But the major theme will end up being, how do we reconnect with these people, these students, without being overly forceful? Because being overly forceful is just going to push them away, which is what the book is about, the use of force I just finished, and it's now we're working on the manuscript proposals to the publishers. And that book is called The Use of Force, because it talks about how force is a necessary part of teaching, but it's also dangerous too, because the more you use it, the more you alienate people. People already feel alienated.
We would like to thank Dr. John Brown, Clinical Associate Professor at the UMass Lowell School of Education, for joining us this month. We look forward to speaking with Professor Brown again in the coming months about his upcoming book, The Use of Force. If you have any questions or comments, please navigate to our website, jfynet.org, which also features a wealth of commentary, dialogue, and free scholastic resources, including this monthly podcast, to support all educational communities. Thank you for joining us. For JFY Networks, I'm Greg Cunningham.